We are perhaps most familiar with the debate going on in music, precipitated to a large extent by Napster. In a New York Times interview in 2002, David Bowie said, "The absolute transformation of everything that we ever thought about music will take place within 10 years. I'm fully confident that copyright, for instance, will no longer exist." The same discussion is taking place throughout the creative realm, in writing, in film, in art, in all digital media. In many ways, it is the same conversation we're having in technology and that we're having here this week. Therefore, those of us who care about open source and free software need to participate as well in the larger discussion of free culture. And that's why Professor Lawrence Lessig is here this morning. He's professor of law at Stanford University and founder of its Center for Internet and Society. He is also founder of the Creative Commons and board member of the Free Software Foundation and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Lessig is also on the board of directors at the Software Freedom Law Center, launched in February of 2005. He's the author of the book Free Culture. And he is best known as a proponent of reduced legal restrictions on copyright, trademark, and radio frequency spectrum, particularly in net technology applications. Please join me in welcoming Professor Lessig.
So all good stories begin like this in a font, like this. In the beginning, there was a network. And that network had a certain core, a certain feature to its logical layer. That feature was freedom. In the design of TCP/IP dedicated to the public domain, that feature instantiated a set of values. Now, of course, not just technically the logical layer. It expanded a bit into the application layer and the physical layer through regulation. But I just want to simplify, because I'm a lawyer, the story a bit and just say it's the logical layer we just think about. A layer embedding values of tolerance for a wide range of content, applications, and business models. The network didn't care what you used it for. Follow the protocols and anyone could run. It's a neutral set of pipes, or as our leaders in Washington refer to it, a neutral set of, quote, tubes that made the internet function. A layer of freedom surrounded by a different set of values, by layers of control. At each of the other layers of this network, there is embedded systems of control that challenge the values at the logical layer. Now, the one most familiar to the community here is the system of control at what I'll call the application layer. Most familiar to my work is the systems of control at the content layer. And increasingly central to the debate in Washington is the systems of control at the physical layer. But I want you to think back 10 years ago to a certain mentality that reigned in Washington and throughout most of the commercial space about why these systems of control had to be, why the network needed them. How it was impossible to imagine a network built except if each of these other layers embedded these values of control. In the first place this debate becomes relevant is the debate about the application layer. Circa 1996, in this building, the Department of Justice, furious meetings were being held about this application. Windows operating system, which the Department of Justice believed was actually this application, a monopoly that the Department of Justice believed had been won illegally. And their question was, how do we best restore competition at that application layer platform? And the general problem, they thought, was that any new operating system would face extremely high costs, and any competition would therefore be a competition to replace one monopoly with another. The most familiar example to them was the effort by this company to build a competing operating system, spending billions of dollars for a competing proprietary operating system, which of course failed. And as the Department of Justice looked to commercial solutions, the thing that they always feared was it would be the same problem, regardless of who was in control. Commercial platforms would be proprietary. Proprietary platforms would seek control. That control would eventually produce monopoly power. Now, 10 years later, it's easy to identify a certain important assumption built into that reasoning. The assumption was that something as complex as an operating system obviously required commercial, proprietary control to build it. It was, quote, impossible to imagine such an operating system developing except within a system of centralized commercial control. But I want you to imagine that time again. Recall how insane it was at that time to imagine a different way to build an operating system. To imagine no proprietary control, no central ownership, operating system built essentially by volunteers around the world putting together something as complex and important as an operating system. Imagine thinking that in 1996, and then imagine the Apple commercial that would have been presented in your honor. Here's to the crazy ones.
The misfits. Rebels.
You, who in 1996 would have imagined this was possible, the crazies, those who said it was possible. Now, of course, there were. 1984, 1991, 1995, there were these crazy people who said such an operating system would be possible, right? They went out and tried to build it with the millions who helped build it. They were the crazy ones taking the obvious point that it couldn't be done and inverting it, taking the crazy and making it now obvious to you. Obvious to you and the rest of the world that the assumption built into the world's thinking in 1996 was just wrong. There was a way to build this operating system, something as complex as this, better through this free and open platform supported by infrastructure of coders and legal code called GPL. This decade since 1996 has proven it possible. This is its symbol, or in Free Software Foundation, we like to think it more like this, the GNU Linux operating system, which did do exactly what the insane person said. So that today, any sane person knows that the impossible to build a free operating system is not just possible, likely superior in an operating system without the centralized proprietary control that was assumed a decade ago. Now, as you think about that weird transformation of what was obvious at one point to what's obvious today, but that these two obvious points are the opposite of each other, I want you to think about that same points in different layers of the network. Can we imagine the same transformation at the content layer? Is it possible to imagine culture being produced, not just in the exclusively proprietary way, but in a different way? And if there were historians who spoke to lawyers who asked these questions, the historians would say, imagine? What are you talking about? You should be saying, can we remember when culture was produced in this different way? 100 years ago this year, this man, John Philip Sousa, traveled to this place, the United States Congress, to talk about this technology, the, quote, talking machines, as Sousa referred to them. Sousa was not a fan of the talking machines. This is what he said. These talking machines are going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country. When I was a boy, in front of every house in the summer evenings, you would find young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. Today, you hear these infernal machines going night and day. We will not have a vocal cord left, Sousa said. The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape. Now, it's this picture of culture I want you to focus on for a second. This is a picture of culture. We could call it, using modern computer terminology, a read-write culture. It's a culture where people participate in the creation and recreation of the culture around them. In that sense, it's read-write. And Sousa's fear was that the capacity for people to engage in this read-write creativity would be lost because of these, quote, infernal machines. These machines would take it away, displace it, and in its place would be the opposite of read-writes, a read-only culture, where creativity is consumed, but the consumer is not a creator. This is culture produced in a top-down way, a world where the vocal cords have been lost. Now, as you look back, the 20th century, in at least what we call the developed world, hard not to conclude that John Philip Sousa was right. Never before in the history of human culture had its production been as concentrated, never before as professionalized. Never before had the peer-to-peer production of culture been as effectively displaced, and displaced, as Sousa predicted, by these, quote, infernal machines. The 20th century was that century where the read-write capacity of our society was displaced by a different sensibility, the sensibility that believes culture, like potato chips, is to be consumed and not created. So when you ask whether it is possible to create a culture where culture is both consumed and produced by people, the first point the historian would say is that of course it's possible, that's the way it was. And increasingly, we can see that's the way it can be again. Because the most exciting explosion of the internet for culture is its opportunity to revive this read-write practice. Not by eliminating read-only culture, but by complementing it. And complementing it so that read-only remains as this read-write develops. So what's read-write, what's read-only culture in the digital age? Well, this is the technology increasingly making it massively efficient to buy and consume culture produced elsewhere. Its ideal is that anytime, anywhere, you can jack into the net and get access to culture, again, created elsewhere. Here's the poster child for this vision of culture. The Apple iTunes Music Store for 99 cents, giving you access to an extraordinary range of culture that you can buy and consume, downloading to your iPod and only your iPod. But you're guaranteed, if you do it in this culture at least, guaranteed to be cool, right? And it's not just music. It's video, increasingly, you can download to your iPod at $1.99, and it's not just Apple, others too. Amazon experimenting with pay-per-page ways of selling books. Ebook companies selling pay-per-read ways of getting access to books. In all of these contexts, these companies are increasingly perfecting the capacity of the content owner to control how people consume culture. That's the read-only internet. Now, at the same time, there's a different internet being built. A read-write internet built by companies like these that are not so much interested in how people consume, though of course consumption is important, much more interested in how people create and share their creativity. give you some examples so we all have this image clear in mind. Explosion of something called anime music videos on the internet. Anime music videos are produced by taking anime, these Japanese cartoons that your kids probably make you more familiar with than you want to be. These cartoons are taken and re-edited and set to music. I'm going to show you two quick clips. All of the art in these clips is found. It's the music that the art is then synchronized to.
Another turn to cry. No, I don't wanna learn the hard way. Baby, hello. Oh no, goodbye. But you got me like a rocket, shooting straight across the sky.
Where's one more familiar? So this is remix, right? Taking digital culture, remixing it in a way that expresses, right? And it's not just anime that are being remixed in this way. Context of music, you all know this album by the Beatles called the White Album, inspiring this album by Jay-Z called the Black Album, inspiring this album by DJ Danger Mouse called the Gray Album, that synthesizes the tracks of the White Album and Black Album together to produce something gray. Or in the context of Ordinary Life, in 2004, this film Tarnation made its debut at Cannes, said by the BBC to wow Cannes. This is a film made for $218. Kid took video he had shot through his whole life and with an iMac remixed it to a level that could wow Cannes and win the 2004 Los Angeles International Film Festival. Or in the context of culture, here's a remixed trailer from this fantastic Chocolate Cake City group.
Time machine you invented.
Or maybe best is in the context of politics. Here are three quick remixes.
Do you ever get the feeling you are living in a virtual reality dream world, fabricated to enslave your mind?
A live all-war edition of American Juniors.
Shake, shake, shake your body.
Yes, yes, shake your body.
Push him up, push him up.
But there is another sound. The sound of goodwill.
Oh, sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I'm far away in a remote place, and we get these things secondhand.
This one's a little simpler to make.
So to answer your question, I just know how this world works. I see on the TV screens how hard it is. We're making progress. It is hard work. You know, it's hard work. It's hard work. A lot of really good people working hard, they can do the hard work. That's what distinguishes us from the enemy. And it's hard work, but it's necessary work, and that's essential. But again, I want to tell the American people, it's hard work. It is hard work. It's hard work. There was no doubt in my mind that's necessary work. I understand how hard it is. That's my job. No doubt about it. It's tough. It's hard work, which I really want to do, but I would hope I never have to. Nothing wrong with that. But again, I repeat to my fellow citizens, we're making progress. We're making progress there. I reject this notion. It's ludicrous. It is hard work. It's hard work. That's the plan for victory, and that is the best way. What I said was, it's hard work, and made that very clear.
And this is my favorite.
My love, there's only you in my life. The only thing that's right.
My first love, your every breath that I take, your every step I make.
And finally, this is Read, Write, Culture. This is digital creativity. It's the creativity these technologies beg for. Creativity that, of course, is not new when you think of films or television for the last 60 years. What's new is that this capacity has been democratized. Anyone with a $1,500 computer can take images and sounds from the culture around us and remix them in a way to express either political ideas or cultural criticism in the most powerful way any of us know how to speak, through video and music. These tools of creativity are now tools of speech, producing a new potential to speak, a new potential to learn. This is the literacy of the 21st century, and its capacity is to revive this read-write culture.